One of the most frequent questions, obviously, we get at the Mises Institute is exactly why are we in Auburn, Alabama? Well, as Dr. Thornton alluded to last night, you know, there were some advantages already here with some Austrian-friendly faculty, with Dr. Roger Garrison and a few others. But the biggest reason we're here is our next speaker, Judge John Denson. He was able to help bring a lot of support, bringing us to this location, and it's because we are here at Auburn, we had a number of students be able to get their PhD here, including several that are teaching this week. Along with being a pillar of the community and the university here in Auburn, with credentials too numerous to list, Judge Denson was elected to a 6-year term in the Circuit Court in 2004, and has been recognized not only as one of the great legal minds in America, but one of the great war historians of our time. He serves as a distinguished scholar with the Mises Institute, and it is my great honor to introduce Judge John Denson.
All right, hear that, all right? I don't know that Judge Napolitano really needs an introduction to this, particularly this group, because you've probably all seen him on TV or you've read his books or you've seen his weekly column. But I want to give you a few details so that you can see how much he is involved every day in promoting individual freedom in the free market and constitutional government. Some of his background is this. He graduated from Princeton University, undergraduate, the University of Notre Dame Law School, and he is the youngest life-tenured Superior Court judge in the history of the state of New Jersey. That's a trial court, and he tried, during that period of time, over 150 jury trials. He has also taught constitutional law in three law schools over a period of 17 years. As the Fox News senior judicial analyst, he served in that position since 1998. He broadcasts nationwide daily on the Fox News Channel, Fox Business Network, and is nationally known for watching and reporting on the government as it interferes with personal liberty, private property, and economic opportunity. Judge lectures nationally on the U.S. Constitution, the rule of law, civil liberties in wartime, which is extremely important, and on human freedom. He's been published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Los Angeles Times, and numerous other publications. His weekly newspaper column is hosted by Washington Times, and I think that LouRockwell.com runs his column regularly each week. And he's also a distinguished scholar in law and jurisprudence at the Mises Institute. The judge is the author of 9 books on the U.S. Constitution. 2 of those books have been on the New York Times bestseller list. And his next book is a 600-page book or legal treatise entitled Natural Law Constitutionalism in America, History and Theory. So you can take a week off and read that. The judge is nationally recognized as a champion of personal freedom. We're very fortunate here at the Mises Institute in Auburn that he takes a whole week off every summer and comes and lectures to the students here at Mises University. And I assure you that the course you're going to hear this week on constitutional law will be better than you would hear in any law school today. When he left his secure lifetime position as a trial judge in New Jersey, where he was defending liberty, he decided to go on the offense, and to use a football term, he threw a Hail Mary pass by going to New York to be on national TV and reach millions of people. There he could reach millions of people every day on his ideas on liberty, constitutional law, as well as reporting on what our government is really doing. He definitely meets my description of a true patriot, which is a person who defends his country by protecting it from its own government. Americans have more to fear their loss of freedom from the enforcement of the unconstitutional, and this is my personal opinion, Americans have more fear to lose their freedom from the enforcement of the unconstitutional Patriot Act and the massive surveillance of all U.S. citizens and non-citizens, and that you do from any alleged enemies in the endless, winless wars in the Middle East. By coming to the Mises University this week, you are definitely taking a step from just defending liberty to going on the offense by learning how to communicate the ideas of liberty and the free market economy. So help me to welcome my good friend, and who is truly a great patriot and super communicator for the ideas of freedom, Judge Andrew Napolitano.
John Denson is such a great man. I can't thank him enough, but I did what Italians from New Jersey don't hesitate to do in public, kissed him. He is a great human being. I'm a little embarrassed discussing the law in front of him because he knows more law than I do, just as I'm embarrassed to be discussing legal philosophy in front of my dear friend Dean Alan Mendenhall because he knows more philosophy than I do. Just as I'm always embarrassed to be in a room with David Gordon because he knows more than anybody does about anything. And of course, without Walter Block here, David Gordon will acknowledge that I am clearly the most libertarian person in the room. So my comments tonight are loosely entitled Taking Rights Seriously. That is from the name of a book by Ronald Dworkin, who those of us who read and study these things dabbled with natural law theory. And I put some ideas, or actually some scribblings up here, which will sort of guide us through this talk about the influence of the natural law on American constitutional law and how that has helped and at times not helped our personal liberty. I'm going to start at the end. And the end is this. Much of what we're going to talk about has become make-believe. Much of the rights that we have are just those that the government lets us have. Much of the exercise of those rights don't come from our humanity, but only when the government lets us exercise them. It's a very sad state of affairs where we are today. Do we still have a constitution in name only? But we'll start at the happier stuff. The AAA here, this is the beginning of the natural law. NLT, usually with the underline under it, stands for natural law tradition. We start with Aristotle. We're about 400 years before the birth of Christ, when he is arguing that if you behave well, you will think clearly, and you will be able to discern right from wrong. We go into the third A now, which is Aquinas. We're about the year 1250 or 1260, and he argues that if you reason well, all human beings who know how to exercise reason will almost inevitably come to the same conclusion as to what's right and what's wrong and what's false and what's true. In the middle of the third A, Augustine, we're now 400 years after the birth of Christ, couldn't have anticipated what Aquinas was going to say. It was 600 years before him. Obviously knew what Aristotle had to say. But Augustine combined the idea of living well and faith with reason. So he argued that pure reason without any temperance leads to nihilism. And pure faith without any reason leads to the most horrific extremes we've seen. Today, we like to look at this, NLT, natural law tradition, as a combination of all three, but we can't accept everything that all three said, and here's why. Because Aquinas defined law as a rule of right reason promulgated by a legitimate authority for the common good, not for the protection of the individual, but for the common good. Aristotle believed that laws should be written, as did Jefferson, that little J-E-F is for Tommy. Aristotle believed that laws should be written to protect the individual. So we have the originators of the natural law tradition, our AAA friends here, not necessarily agreeing with each other. But the natural law today, I want to tell you, is this. Now, that does not stand for Napolitano. That stands for the non-aggression principle, which is the root and core of natural law libertarianism, which of course condemns the initiation of force. The initiation of force, obviously you can use force to resist force, it condemns the initiation of force on property, on persons, and on liberty. This is absolutely consistent with natural law tradition, but it basically distills from Aristotle, from Augustine, from Aquinas, the primacy of the individual over the state, and the only legitimate role that government has. If you read the Declaration of Independence, you'll see that. If you're taking the course with me, we're going to go through the Declaration of Independence line by line. We're also going to do that with the Constitution, which is the other side of this line. These are the good guys. This is the stuff that's brought us where we are today. That the only legitimate purpose, the only legitimate role that government serves is to preserve individual liberty. That is at least the theory of what Jefferson meant when he wrote. You all know this phrase. That all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay, endowed by their creator, that brings us back to Aquinas. Do you have to believe in God the Father, or do you have to believe in a supreme being in order to accept natural law tradition or the non-aggression principle? The answer is no. And Aquinas gave us that by his argument of the primacy of reason. And if you read Murray Rothbard, who's the contemporary interpreter of Aquinas' use of reason, you will see by the exercise of human reason, we can discern right from wrong, truth from falsity, without necessarily believing in a God. Now, I'm an old-fashioned, pre-Vatican II, Latin mass attending, receiving communion on the tongue, you know what I'm talking about, Roman Catholic. But you don't have to have this kind of a traditional, old-fashioned Catholicism in order to accept the primacy of the individual over the state and the fact that our rights come from within us, because Jefferson said so in the Declaration of Independence. The other day I was in air with somebody, a brilliant legal scholar, I don't want to mention his name, just you wouldn't find him here. And he said, you know, it's too bad the Declaration of Independence wasn't enacted as a statute. It was. This is the first legislation enacted by the Congress. Now, it's the pre-constitutional Congress. But if you go to the United States Code, the old version of the code, in which the statutes are written in the order in which they were enacted, the first statute is this. So when the president takes an oath to uphold federal law, he's taking an oath to uphold this, which says that our rights are inalienable. Are our rights inalienable? Is your right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness inalienable? Is your freedom of speech, your right to associate, or the flip side of that, your right not to associate, your right to worship, or your right not to worship, your right to petition the government? Does that mean the government has to answer your petition? Are these rights really inalienable, or can the government take them away from you? Aquinas, what would be the Thomistic reason for taking them away? For the common good, the excuse the government always uses, and unfortunately they got it from another Tommy, this one, Aquinas. All these rights, your right to self-defense, which according to Justice Scalia in the Heller case, means self-defense using the same materials and equipment that the government uses. Can you put a tank in your garage? Does the Second Amendment defend your right to do that? Well, if the government is taken over by monsters, they're not going to come after us with 22s. They're going to come after us with something that will do the most damage. Do we have the right to resist the government? Should the government live in fear that we have the same firepower that it does? Or will the government just let us have weapons for target practice? You know, you can go on and on and on through the entire Bill of Rights. We're already over here with little Jimmy. That's James Madison, who was all of 5'2". So I would love to stand next to Madison because I'd look like Shaquille O'Neal. But he was known as Little Jimmy. Of course, he's the author of the Constitution. We're not there yet. We're still here. If we take rights seriously, if we take what Jefferson said seriously, if you read this entire document, mean, half of it is an indictment against the king. But the other half is an unbelievably beautiful, logical, rational manifestation of human liberty and its origin as being within us. Jefferson, who was a deist, believed his own mind was his own God. Nevertheless, perhaps to get a unanimous vote in the Second Continental Congress, get everybody to sign it, referred to the creator as the originator of human liberty. So if there's two lessons to come from Jefferson's declaration, it is, what is the origin of our rights? And is any government moral that lacks the consent of the governed? Now, the kings never claimed the consent of the governed because they claimed that they ruled by divine right, that somehow it was God's will that George III should be the king of England and the American colonists. Jefferson, of course, argued the very radical, at the time, in 1776 idea that no government is moral without the consent of the governed, and we do not consent to the king or to Parliament. The argument was, you know this phrase, taxation without representation is tyranny. That was a mythical argument. They did not want representation in the Parliament. They wanted to be divorced from the Parliament. They wanted to have nothing to do with the Parliament and the king. But they used this taxation without representation is tyranny because it sounded good and it helped bring about a consensus for human liberty. One of the things that brought about a consensus that made it easy for the Declaration to come about was the need of the king for what do kings always need? Money. So in order to raise money, they enacted a number of bizarre taxes and regulations called the Intolerable Acts, sometimes called the Townshend Acts, under one of George III's prime ministers, whose last name was Townshend. We'll just talk about one of these because it's one of my favorites, called the Stamp Act. Now, the Stamp Act required that every house in the colonies, not in Great Britain, if this were the law in Great Britain, the king would have suffered the same fate as Louis XVI in Paris did. But in the colonies, you had to have on every piece of paper in your home, every book, every pamphlet, even a poster you're going to nail to a tree, every letter, every financial document, the king's stamp. Where did you get the stamp? You went to a vendor in the colonies who was authorized by the king to sell the stamps. Question, how did the king and the parliament 3,000 miles away know if you had a stamp on every piece of paper in your home? Answer, the Writs of Assistance Act. See if this sounds familiar. The Writs of Assistance Act permitted the government to appear before a secret court and ask the court for a general warrant. A general warrant authorizes the bearer to search where he wishes and seize whatever he finds. There's no description of the reason for the warrant or of the person, place, or thing to be searched. So it would not be uncommon for there to be a knock on your door, it's now 1765, and a very polite British soldier would show you the general warrant, and his troops would go in the house. We're here to look for the stamps. Of course, while they're there, they might take food, they might take furniture. If you couldn't show that you had paid the king's tax on furniture because you may have imported it from the islands, they might even take over the house, which is why we have the Third Amendment that perhaps prohibits the quartering of troops against the wishes of the owner. The Stamp Act was so unpopular that it was actually rescinded a year later. The Writs of Assistance Act, which permitted this secret FISA-like court to exist in London to issue general warrants to search the private property of persons living in the colonies, survived the Stamp Act. One of the ways that the Stamp Act fell was some very bright students at the College of New Jersey, now called Princeton, did a little bit of math and thought, and concluded that, my God, George III is stupid, but what's going on here? It costs more to enforce the Stamp Act than it generated in revenue. The head scratcher. What government that's looking for money would cost more to enforce the tax than the tax produced in revenue? Unless The purpose of the Stamp Act was not to generate money, but was to remind the colonists that the king was still the king. And he and the person of his agents and soldiers could cross your threshold at a whim and look for whatever they wanted. Well, the Stamp Act was such a colossal mistake, it actually began, according to Professor Balin, still writing at age 9, I don't know why I'm looking at David when I say this, but still writing at age 96 at Harvard, who has read just about everything there was in the original sources at the time, primarily pamphlets and sermons. If you want to read the book, it's called The Ideological Origins of the American Constitution. Professor Balin opines that before the Stamp Act, the colonists were pretty much divided, about one-third in favor of revolution, one-third in favor of staying with the king, and one-third, could you imagine somebody having no opinion, but about one-third had no opinion as to whether or not there should be a revolution. After the Stamp Act, the tide is turning radically in favor of revolution. That, of course, makes this very popular. The fact that about two-thirds of those living in the colonies, not 100%, two-thirds, very much supported this radical idea that our rights come from our humanity and our humanity is a gift from God. Now, if rights are truly inalienable, or is it make-believe, but if rights are truly inalienable, then they cannot be taken away by the government. They cannot be taken away by majority vote. They can only be given away by one's behavior. If I rob a bank, I give up my right to be free, and the government can take my rights away from me if I rob a bank. But can I take my rights away from me? I'm going to pick on Aquinas again, for the common good. Well, if the government can take my rights away from me for the common good, then my rights are not inalienable. And if my rights are not inalienable, then the Declaration of Independence is make-believe. Every president has sworn an oath to uphold federal law, which includes the Declaration of Independence. Do they really mean that our rights are inalienable? It's crystal clear that the origin of human liberty in Jeffersonian understanding, even all three of these, our AAA would agree, that the origins of human liberty are our humanity, and our humanity is a gift from God. If you really believe in a traditional God, if you believe we're created in his image and likeness, what's the one thing that we have in absolute common with him? Perfect freedom. We have the freedom to do ill and the freedom to do good. Where did we get that freedom from him? Well, it came from him, or if it comes from our humanity, and if it's truly inalienable, how can the government take us away? Take it away, again, unless this is make-believe. To the second of Jefferson's principles from the Declaration, which is the consent of the governed. This was an easy argument for Jefferson to make. Both of these arguments were novel and radical in 1776. But this was an easy argument for Jefferson to make because it was easy for the untutored to understand it. Did you consent to the king? No. Well, do you consent to the king by living here in areas that over which the king claims jurisdiction? No. Are you a member of the Church of England? No. Did you consent to the tax to support the Church of England? No. Do you pay the tax? Yes. Why do you pay the tax? I don't want to go to jail. Why does anybody pay taxes? You're at home one night, and the doorbell rings. You open the door. A guy's got a gun. He points the gun at you and says, "Give me your money. I want to give it away in your name." Oh my God, what the hell is this all about? You call the police. He is the police. He works for the IRS. Let's get back to Jefferson, who argued that the only moral commercial transaction is one that is truly voluntary. So if we pay our taxes not voluntarily, but to stay out of jail, is that a moral commercial transaction? It is not. And the great Mary Rothbard did not hesitate for a minute to say that taxation is theft. Man, when I say that on air, you wouldn't believe the emails. Both extremes. Why doesn't anybody else at Fox say that? Or the judge is off his meds. What does he mean taxation is theft? Back to the consent of the governed. This was a great argument. what Jefferson also wrote about 10 years after he left the presidency. This is a very instructive thing to read, the Jefferson Adams letters. Get it in a paperback. You know, they couldn't write too many letters because it took about 2 months for a letter to get from Charlottesville to Boston or Boston to Charlottesville. And of course, they hated each other. Jefferson was Adams' vice president, and they didn't speak. Well, why wouldn't the vice president speak to the president? Do you remember how everybody was elected in those days? Everybody ran for president. Whoever finished first became president. Whoever finished second became vice president. Could you imagine that in the modern era? Hillary? Hillary? Can you attend that funeral for me today, Hillary? So they didn't speak, and then of course 4 years later, Jefferson ran against Adams again, and this time Jefferson won. But for 40 years they wrote these letters. They both died on the same day. They both died on the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But it's very instructive to Jefferson's mind because he's unconstrained by what the public thinks in his latter years. So he argued that all the laws, including this, the Constitution, should be thrown out every 19 years. That was a generation in that era. So the same philosopher who said the blood of patriots should be spilled on the tree of revolution at least once in every generation meant what he said. He defined a generation as 19 years, and he said, because the government needs consent. We can't just assume that because we go outside and walk on government sidewalks or use government streets that we consent. Did the Jews of Berlin consent to the Nazis because they used the sidewalks or the streets that the government owned in the mid-30s? Of course not. Consent must be an actual, active, affirmative, individual acceptance of the government. And absent that consent, according to Jefferson and the Declaration of Independence, unless it's make-believe, absent that consent, the government is not valid and there is no duty to comply with its commands. You with me on all this? Is this a little distressing, the make-believe aspect? I don't think anything is new to you. You're smart people, which is why you're here. By the way, just as a little aside, I've teased David Gordon and John Denson and Dean Mendenhall and some of my other colleagues who I see scattered about the audience here, my fellow faculty. By the way, the faculty usually sits in the back because they don't want me to call on them. You know, just like this was some first-year class in the Constitution, the wise guys are in the back. They are some extremely, extremely bright people. Pick their brains, challenge them, talk to them in the hallway. Grab me by the lapel and ask me a question. I am the least of the 15 faculty here. You are blessed to have the people teaching you that will be teaching you this week. Do you know anybody that's consented to the Constitution? Do you know anybody that's consented to the government? Let's see, if you voted for Hillary, did you consent to the government of Donald Trump? If you voted for Donald Trump, did you consent to the government of Donald Trump? Is there any living human being that personally consents to this? Jefferson understood this, which is why he argued. And it's in a letter to John Adams. It's not in a famous speech, and most people don't even know it existed. That all these things on this side, what the heck is this? This is the monster we'll get to in a minute. Pee in a circle. All these things on this side, even this, which was written by his buddy, Madison, should be wiped out once in every generation, so that whatever the government is, it truly and literally exists by the consent of the governed. Pee in a circle is the opposite of natural law tradition and the opposite of the non-aggression principle. It stands for positivism. And positivism is the theory that the law is whatever the lawgiver says it is, whoever the lawgiver may be. Tyrant, or a popular majority. I've been arguing for years that a popular majority is worse than a tyrant, because the popular majority claims legitimacy by virtue of, well, we were elected, but it can be just as tyrannical. I mean, Judge Denson spoke earlier about the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act is the most damnable, abominable piece of legislation since the Alien and Sedition Acts, which punished people for speech. The Alien and Sedition Acts, enacted in 1796 under the presidency of John Adams, made it a crime to utter a falsehood about the Congress, the government, or the president. Now, who's not in that list? The vice president. Well, it was Jefferson. He wasn't going to be protected by the Federalist Congress, and he didn't want their protection anyway. So one of my favorite historical characters, some of you have heard this story, but I have to tell it again, the Ron Paul of his age, who was a congressman from Vermont, decides he's going to challenge the Alien and Sedition Acts. Now, he can't challenge it on the floor of the House of Representatives because the Speech and Debate Clause insulates members of Congress from being prosecuted for what they say on the floor of either house. But he decides that he will challenge the Alien and Sedition Acts in front of the Capitol building, which isn't yet built. John Adams, who was the president, had a problem that a lot of middle-aged men do, even today, an ever-growing waistline. So in order to cover the waistline, Mrs. Adams gave him a purple robe that she sewed. She didn't like the way the purple looked, so she sewed gold epaulets on the shoulders. This guy's beginning to look more like George III with the passing of every tick of the clock. So he's walking down the street, and Congressman Matthew Lyons of Vermont, our hero, approaches the president and says, "Good morning, your pomposity." Right, Adams is not happy about this. There are a couple of witnesses. Somebody wrote it down. It shows up in a newspaper in Boston a month later. Nothing happens. You know, he really wanted to get arrested. So the second time he shows up, with a lot of media, as it was of the era, in tow, and says to the president, "Good morning, your rotundity." And for that, uttering a falsehood, I mean, Adams was as wide as he was tall. At his trial, he was indicted for slandering the president of the Alien and Sedition Act. At his trial, his defense was truth, that Adams was rotund, that calling him rotundity was not a falsehood. But Matthew Lyons was convicted. He expected the trial to be a joke. He was convicted in Boston. The crime occurred in Washington. He was convicted in Boston. If you read the indictment against the king and the Declaration of Independence, one of the charges is, "And he has taken us to foreign places to try us for pretend crimes." Exactly what Adams did to Matthew Lyons. Crime, in quotes, in D.C., a foreign place. To a Yankee fan, Boston is still a foreign place. Tried him before a jury in Boston. He was convicted. He served 2 years in a dungeon in Western Massachusetts. And then he did something while he was there, which, if you are from Chicago, Boston, New Orleans, or Jersey City, New Jersey, you're familiar with this phenomenon. He ran for re-election from his jail cell. And he won. Gets out of jail, goes to D.C., thinking, "What am I going to say to John Adams now? They threw me in jail when I called him your rotundity." Adams is gone. Instead of the short, as wide as he was tall, purple robe, gold epaulette wearing John Adams was the tall, thin as a reed, raven-haired defender of human liberty, author of the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson, who pardons Congressman Lyons, returns the 480 acres of farmland that the government had seized as a result of this one phrase that came out of his mouth. Jefferson proceeds to pardon everybody who had been convicted under the Alien and Sedition Acts. Of course, by the time Jefferson became president, there was no Alien and Sedition Act. Why not? Because the Federalist Congress, which enacted that awful statute so that the Federalist Department of Justice could prosecute anti-Federalists, when they lost the election and Jefferson became president, said, "We better get rid of this statute or they'll start using it on us." So by the time Jefferson is in the White House, there is no Alien and Sedition Act. When I used to give talks like this back when President Obama was in office, I would say, I want everybody to turn off their iPhone. In those days, people had Blackberries. I don't know if Blackberries exist anymore. I want you to turn them on, because I want President Obama to hear everything I'm about to say. Everybody would laugh. Yeah, you turn the iPhone on and he can hear what you say. Now, of course, you can't turn it off. You may think it's off, but it's not off. Now, of course, it tells the government where you are at every minute that it's with you, and the government captures every keystroke, even those which you think you have deleted on this. When people said to me, why did you oppose so vigorously the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh? I mean, it had nothing to do with his frat boy behavior, or alleged frat boy behavior. It had to do with this. I mean, the Fourth Amendment says you want to get in this, get a warrant. Even if you're an originalist like Antonin Scalia, the Fourth Amendment applies to persons, houses, papers, and effects. Aha! Isn't the computer chip in here an effect? Not in Brett Kavanaugh's world. In his world, the majority can authorize federal agents to enter this wirelessly, so you don't even know that they have entered it. Well, if the origin of human liberty is our humanity, and the origin of our humanity is a gift from God, if these things are really inalienable, how can the government just take them away? The other day, I interviewed a guy at Fox who's an expert on drones, and he says to me, I know you don't want to hear this, but the government has drones that are 5 miles up in the sky that can see your fingernails. What government? Federal government. Did Congress ever authorize this? No. What does Congress do when these things happen? Looks the other way. So that the power of the government can increase and the power of the individual will decrease. Positivism, of course, is the mortal enemy of natural law and of the non-aggression principle, because under positivism, whatever the government says is the law is the law. There is no natural law restraint. Rights are not integral to our humanity. Rights are what the government gives away. So the government could give rights to some people and not to others. Even under Nazi Germany, under positivism, those awful, horrific laws, the Nuremberg laws, were valid laws under the theory of positivism, because the lawgiver was giving them. Under this horrific theory, again, I'll repeat, the law is whatever the lawgiver says it is. I'm so sorry to have the Constitution on this side, the positivism side of this bar, as opposed to the natural law and non-aggression side, because the Constitution, written by Jefferson's buddy, he would, in fairness to him, before he died, he would repudiate a lot of what is in here. But he is the principal author, the sole scrivener, took the notes at the convention in Philadelphia in 1787, and actually refined a lot of the words of the Constitution. He's also the principal manipulator behind the existence of the Constitutional Convention and the 13-month-long period during which the convention, the Constitution is being ratified. Bypassing Congress, bypassing the state legislatures, creating conventions in each state filled primarily with Federalists, people who wanted a strong central government. In this era, on this side of the line, before the Constitution, we had the Articles of Confederation, which those of us who like small government really liked. Only Murray Rothbard was astute enough to call the Articles of Confederation a halfway house to central government. And of course, it was, because in a false effort to amend it, promulgated by little Jimmy, the Constitutional Convention exists in secret for 3 months in a windowless room in a swamp in Philadelphia, and they write this new document. They don't amend the Articles of Confederation. They write this new document. Jefferson's not around. He's in Paris. I don't know what he was doing, but he was there as the U.S. ambassador to Paris. There was no president of the United States at the time. the Constitution is ratified. The Constitution, of course, is pure positivism, except for the Bill of Rights, which Madison reluctantly went along with, but did write. I mean, who's the most influential person in American history? This little Jimmy wrote the Constitution and wrote the Bill of Rights. They sent 12 amendments to the states. The first two had to do with the organization and pay of Congress. States didn't want anything to do with them. So the First Amendment, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. You all know that one. Does no law really mean no law? Can Julian Assange really go to jail for uttering a truthful statement about the federal government? I guess we'll find out. Or is even that make-believe? Nevertheless, the first 8 amendments to the Constitution constitute the Bill of Rights, and they basically tick off the rights that we sort of take for granted, starting with the first and going down to the 8th. The ninth is little Jimmy having regret over the Constitution, going back to this, to foretaste of that. This phrase wasn't around in 1791 when little Jimmy wrote the amendments. Certainly natural law tradition was, because the ninth says, basically, the rights enumerated in this document are not exhaustive, and the government shall recognize all the other rights that exist. Shall recognize the other rights that exist. Well, if they exist and they're not in the document, where'd they come from? Ah! They must be natural. Today, of course, even somebody like Scalia didn't like to use this phrase. Why didn't you call it natural right? Why didn't you say the right to keep and bear arms was a natural right? That sounds too Catholic. I was worried I wouldn't get a majority of votes. So the terminology today for natural rights has a secular phrase to it. It's pre-political rights or fundamental rights. So if you hear the court say something is pre-political, the right is pre-political, that means the court believes it existed before the government did. If it existed before the government did, where did it come from? Well, if you follow Tommy, it came from our humanity. If you follow what the courts do today, law is whatever the lawgiver says it is, then it is whatever the government wants it to be. Here's the most modern use of the natural law, which drove Scalia crazy because of his Catholicism. I mean, I'm an old-fashioned Catholic, but I celebrate this case. This is Obergefell. This is the same-sex marriage opinion. This basically says it's none of the government's business who you want to get married, because the right to choose a mate is such an intimate choice, it is immunized by this, by the natural law, from any touch by the government. Of course, they didn't call it a natural right, they called it pre-political or fundamental. In my book, to which Judge Stenson made a very generous reference, it is a doorstop, but it is the history and theory of all this. We traced, there's nothing like it in the literature. I'm not here to sell the book. There's nothing like it in the literature. We traced every opinion of the Supreme Court that expressly accepted the natural law tradition or rejected the natural law tradition. And the last case to accept it is Justice Anthony Michael Kennedy writing Obergefell, which is only about 4 or 5 years ago. What does the Supreme Court interpret? This is SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States. Well, it interprets this. And if this is whatever the people who wrote it say it means, or whatever SCOTUS says it means, where does the natural law come in? Well, occasionally it rears its head, like in Obergefell. I mean, at the time they wrote this, this decision, same-sex marriage was only lawful in a half dozen states. So they really triumphed over, just in this one area that doesn't apply to a large percentage of the population. Nevertheless, the jurisprudence, the legal arguments that go into this can be used in many other areas. That as recently as 2008, the court will recognize the existence of a right that is not articulated anywhere. And how can they recognize it? Because of the Ninth Amendment in that. Ninth Amendment was Murray Rothbard's favorite. The Ninth Amendment is the linchpin of this book that Judge Denson just told you I've just finished writing. It's 4 years of the work, so it's a lot of work. You know, you said it's 600 pages, but what you didn't say is there are 1,600 footnotes. I know a couple of faces here that'll read all those footnotes. All right, so where does all this leave us? Do we still have a constitution? We have it. What is it? Whatever the people in power say that it means. They can pull an Obergefell on us and follow the natural rights, or they can keep expanding Congress's power. One of the things we'll talk about in my class, for those of you taking it, is the Commerce Clause, which authorizes Congress to regulate interstate commerce. Little Jimmy defined interstate commerce as the movement of goods between merchants as they cross interstate lines. So the state of New Jersey cannot put a tariff on wheelbarrows made in New York, and the tariff is so high that no wheelbarrow maker could sell his goods in New York. The purpose of the Commerce Clause was to get rid of those interstate tariffs. Of course, the Commerce Clause reaches just about everything you can see in this room, because SCOTUS has so expanded the meaning of commerce to the anything that would affect interstate commerce. Congress regulates the pigment in the paint on the chairs and the rug in this room and on the shirts, t-shirts, and jeans that everybody is wearing, and they do so under the Commerce Clause. This is pure, pure positivism. Do we still have a constitution? Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Does no law really mean no law? Can somebody be punished for publishing the truth about the government because it embarrasses the government? What did Assange publish? Videos of American military killing innocent civilians in Afghanistan and rejoicing over it. Not only did the government deny that it happened, the government denied that there was any evidence for it when the government knew the evidence existed. Now they want to put this kid in jail because he told all of us of the horrors of war. By the way, one of the greatest contemporary scholars of the anti-war movement is the person who introduced me tonight, John Denson, an Alabama lawyer and judge who's one of the leading lights in why war is the health of the state and must be resisted at all costs. And he's seated right here in the front row. Touch that hand before you leave so you can touch greatness. Where is she? And this is his lovely bride. Government requires make-believe. Make-believe the king is divine. Make-believe he can do no wrong. Make-believe the voice of the people is the voice of God. Make-believe the people have a voice. Make-believe that the representatives of the people are the people. Make-believe that all men are created equal. Make-believe that they're not. Make-believe whatever you want. And if it's promulgated by those in power, everybody else will accept it. Except when this comes along. This is our last best hope. This argument that our rights come from our humanity, that all aggression on persons, property, or liberty, all initiated aggression, is morally wrong and indefensible. These two arguments will occasionally negate all this stuff, as they did. It doesn't happen every day, and you never know when it's going to happen, as they did here in Obergefell. All right, thank you, my friends. It's always a pleasure. I look forward to spending the week with you.